Hello, and welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest returns to speak not about his numerous horror novels, but about his wildly successful podcast and future Amazon television show, Lore. Please welcome Aaron Mankey to the show.
Harry, how are you?
Aaron, my friend, welcome back.
Thank you much for having me.
So we'll get right into it. To the three people who have not heard Lore yet, what is your elevator pitch for the show?
I'm sure there's more than three people, at least 10, right?
Yeah, maybe a dozen.
Right. So what I tell people is, Lore is a podcast that explores dark historical tales about people, places, and things that tend to border on the supernatural or the mysterious. It's done in a narrative storytelling style that's sort of like sitting around a campfire, just me and some background music. And I release it every other Monday. And yeah, like you said, a few people listen to it.
Nice. When you first started it, it reminded me very heavily of a magazine I used to read when I was in high school. And I think it's still coming out, but they had released a book also. It was Weird New Jersey, which is all about the weird, trippy stuff that goes on in my home state. And some of it supernatural, some of it just kooky people who sit by the roadside and, you know, wave at people. But you know, stuff like the Jersey Devil would pop up in there and some of the more, you know, apparently our state was a big haven for the KKK. So there were stories of that stuff going on. So there was a lot of weird stuff going on in haunted roads and things. So your show always reminded me of that.
Nice.
So what is the typical life cycle for an episode from inception to recording?
You mean like the process of building it from start to finish?
Exactly.
I have 2 weeks between episodes. Just by design at the very beginning, I said, yeah, I'll do this every other week. And I'm really glad I did because it takes a lot of time to put them together. So what's that? 80 hours between the 2 weeks. It usually takes me about 40 hours to research, write, and then record and produce one episode. And then the other week of that 2 week cycle is spent, you know, sprinkled here and there doing all the business. I have press and things like that I have to do every week, and meetings with different projects. My literary agent, TV stuff. I hopped off a meeting right before this, and I'll hop on another meeting after this. So
it all keeps me pretty right busy. Here.
What's that?
Just going to curse silently. You silently right here.
This is a really weird place that I'm in. It's just like I realize how incredibly unusual it is, and I try to stay as small-headed about it as I possibly can. But helping me in all of that work, I have a research assistant now. I brought her on at the beginning of the summer. She's a college junior at the moment, but she's studying anthropology, history, and sociology. And so she has a good, and she's got an interest in kind of the weird and unusual as well. So she fits in really, really nicely. And that helps a lot. So she gathers all the raw information for me for an episode. And then we use Google Docs, and she hands, you know, whatever she's found, she's outlined it and linked to sources. And if it has screenshots of books or things like that, she's put it all in there. And then I take all of that material and I read it all. Honestly, that's so much of my job. It's just, I read. And I read it all. I soak it all in. And then I get these headaches that I call research headaches because I've crammed everything that I possibly can into my brain. And then I have to step away from the computer. And then I sometimes it's my subconscious, and sometimes it's me actively hitting my head against a wall saying, okay, how can I make sense of all this? Where's the story? Where's the flow? What's the outline supposed to look like? Mm-hmm. And once I've got that sorted out, I write the outline and then fill in gaps that I might find or explore new areas of context that I might, you know, think up while I'm outlining it. And then I'm ready to start. So I start writing. And it's a pretty structured flow for each episode. You know, an intro that brings the theme in, a summary that wraps it up, and then, you know, some sections in the middle that move the story along. And I can usually get that done. It's about 3,500 words or so, and it takes me about 4 or 5 writing sessions to knock that out.
So when you write, you're writing basically an essay/script of the episode, right?
Yeah, you know, I tell people it's kind of like a history term paper that's written as if it was the transcript of you telling your teacher the term paper as opposed to writing it out. You know, I think there's a difference between writing for the written word and writing for the spoken word. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to wonder about people who write speeches for like political candidates. You know, think of Toby on The West Wing. You know, did he write things in a more conversational, yet professional? I get that aspect, but in some way just different so that it fits the mouth better. Because when you read without your mouth, you don't have to worry as much about alliteration, right? You don't have to worry about how the fact that this word ends with a hard K sound and the next word starts with a hard K sound. And that's really awkward when you're trying to read it out loud. And I have to pay attention to stuff like that.
That brings me to my next question. When you write, do you write in the beats and the pauses, or are those things you do on the fly?
I don't write like beat to tell myself, okay, this is where I take a break. But I tend to structure my paragraphs around that. So if I know that I need to take a pause to let a fact sink in, or to let people have a moment to transition to the next thought, I will just start a new paragraph. So, you know, every now and then I might have a script that ends up looking a little weird because it'll have paragraph, and then there might be one sentence on a line, right? And then a new paragraph starts after that. And that's just my way of kind of structuring the voiceover flow, I guess.
Right. You're basically making music, which is what it sounds like. I've been a musician most of my life, and specifically saxophone. And growing up, it was, you know, where you put the breath mattered. And, you know, it was all about the phrasing. So if you put a breath in the middle of a phrase, or if you're a singer, if you put a breath in the middle of a phrase and you break up the sentence, then you've taken the listener out of what they were listening to. And now they don't hear a song, they hear someone singing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and some of the criticism that I get, if I make the mistake of reading iTunes reviews, some people complain about, I don't know, the pacing or pauses, but I think that if you think about performance art, not just sitting around a table and talking into a microphone, because that's a really different, you know, I'm talking differently to you now than I would on a recording of my show, because in my mind, I'm performing that episode for the microphone. You know, I've rehearsed it. I know where I want to inflect and where I don't want to inflect. And I know where I want to put the pauses and where I don't want to put the pauses. And I rehearse that so that when I record it, it's almost like I'm an actor, you know, and there have to be pauses. You have to have pacing in order for it to be connected and to have emotion and to feel, you know?
Right.
So I try to build pacing into that.
Right. It's like listening to a newscaster be interviewed. There's the interview voice and the everyday speaking voice. And then there's the news voice. And,
right.
And also with you, your show is about building atmosphere and building a mood and a motif. And so a lot of that has to do with how you phrase things and how your stories are written.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to use certain metaphors because it might... A certain metaphor might break the mood. I want a lot of my content to be timeless. So I might not, you know, you're not going to hear me talk about iPhone 7 on the show, but I might talk about mobile technology, you know, because it's a bit more of a timeless concept.
Right.
You know, just in a way of helping it becomes more relatable to more people at the same time that way too.
Is there a worry of the content being timeless? I mean, people still listen to Orson Welles's War of the Worlds, and that's fairly outdated by all comparisons.
Well, I think that in podcasts in general, there's a mix of that. You have evergreen content and you have, you know, very, is ephemeral the right word? I'd have to look that up in a thesaurus. But content that's outdated and old next week. And that doesn't make it invaluable, because for people who, you know, if you really want to know what happened at an Apple event, you know, last week, then you'll listen to, you know, one of the many podcasts that are out there that talk about that thing. And if you listen to it in a timely fashion, you're going to get some good information that might help you buy the right computer for you or pick the next great phone for your family. But 6 months later, that episode doesn't have a lot of shelf life. So I think it's just a different way of doing things. It's not timeless, right? Because of its nature. But I think that the content that I create, at least I hope it is more in the realm of literature in the sense that it's storytelling, right? It's a story that you can sit down and listen to. And I hear from people all the time who, you know, even though a lot of my episodes involve some sort of a twist at the end that you weren't expecting to hear, they'll listen to the episodes more than once. So I think it does speak to the evergreen quality.
Yeah, there's that worry in fiction too with people. I know I talk to writers who are always worried about putting in a reference to even just texting or email or Facebook or Twitter because they're worried that their books or their stories are going to be seen 10 years from now as basically being obsolete if those services are no longer used. But, you know, right. Fiction goes back hundreds, thousands of years. I mean, there's always something outdated. You know, we don't type on typewriters anymore. I mean, I do, but you know, people don't type on typewriters anymore. People don't, you know, listen to gramophones anymore. I mean, it's always going to be outdated. There's always going to be some new big thing. And I guess there's just, you have to balance it with what's going to tell the better story now versus worrying about what it's going to look like in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I like reading somebody like Stephen King, you know, whose career spans so many decades and in doing so spans a lot of technology changes, a lot of social, political changes. And, you know, if you listen to one of his, because I do a lot of audiobooks, so if I listen to one of his brand new books, you'll hear things where he might mention Facebook or Twitter or something that you feel is rooted in your current modern life. And it's easy to think, oh, that almost feels too new and too real to mention in a book. But then, you know, read something that he wrote 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and you realize that he's been doing it all along, right? You just kind of miss over those parts or skip over those parts because you take it for granted. And I think, you know, I think it gives an added grain of reality to fiction when you bring in real elements like that, you know? I think it's true fantasy if you're writing a novel where nobody's used Facebook, because most people have. So throw it in there. Do that.
Yeah. I mean, look at Misery. Paul Sheldon writes on a typewriter and, you know, he needs just the right kind of paper to do his, but you wouldn't see that kind of thing these days. But we still go back to that story because the characters are so vivid and interesting. And, you know, the story itself is so inviting. So, you know, as long as the story is solid, the little details don't really matter so much in the long run.
Right. They're the wardrobe, right? And dress style and fashion changes, you know, every few years. And so the actors are the same, but the what they're wearing is different. Yeah.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nocht Sound Engineering. Nocht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nocht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nocht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nocht Sound Engineering today at nochtsound.com. That's nachtsound.com. Nocht, more than a stack of tracks. You had mentioned your research assistant, and I know you because you're a very hands-on guy. So what is it like handing over that kind of control?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a control freak, and I'm willing to admit that. I'm also a little OCD, you know, I like things to be done a certain way, and they have a process. But I realized early on that there's just a ton of stuff that I can't hand off to somebody else. You know, most of it's me related, not in a selfish sense, just that like no one else can write the episodes and certainly no one else can record the episodes because I'm the voice of lore, literally and figuratively. So, you know, that's a limit for me. But, you know, Marcette, my research assistant, she's been a huge positive change in that aspect because she helps save me some time by going out and she can follow the rabbit trails that would tie me up and waste my time. And for her, it's more of an exploration of, you know, how far can I take this topic and what sources can I bring into it? And I let her go do all of that. And so she saves me, you know, a lot of the time. I still get to read everything. And then I'm ultimately the one who decides, does this cultural reference need to be in the episode or does it not need to be? You know, she's not forcing me to put content in, I still get to make that executive decision. So it's still me. But, you know, there's other aspects. I like my show to sound a certain way. I like my production to be done a certain way. And I don't know that I think it comes down to like my gut, my intuition. I don't want to outsource the things that I've leaned on my intuition for so far. Because what if that person doesn't have the right intuition or intuition that aligns with mine? And it's hard, you know?
Well, your gut's gotten you this far, so it's obviously doing something right.
It has. It has. You know, at some point, there's only so much of me to go around, and I have to make those decisions on, you know, there's 20 things on the table that I only have time for 5 of them. Which 5 do I hold on to for dear life, and which 15 do I delegate? And I'm doing that more and more now, but I still am holding on to as much as I can for as long as I can. Mm-hmm. And that might be a bad thing. It might hold the show back, or it might be, you know, my attempt to maintain as much personality in the show as I can. I don't know yet what it's going to be. Even things like Twitter, right? And Facebook and Instagram, I represent Lore on social media myself. I don't hire some other company. I had somebody reach out yesterday on email to say, hey, I've got this company that manages social media for people. We'd love to do it for you. Deleted. I don't want to do that. But maybe it's a dumb choice.
No, it adds authenticity, and people know that they're talking to you and not some marketing person on the other side. And I think that adds to the value of the show and, like you said, the voice.
Yeah, absolutely.
But who initiates the topics? Do you give your assistant a list of things that you're interested in covering, or does she come to you with things she thinks are interesting?
Well, that's another trust issue. You know, I have really strict and high bars set for the kind of story that I tell on Lore, because, I mean, I get sent ideas all the time, you know, dozens a week of, you know, check this out, check that out. You know, a common one is, I don't know how to pronounce the name of it, but it's a forest in Japan where many, many people have gone and killed themselves. It's a really creepy idea, but there's no story. The moment you tell people there's a forest in Japan where people go and kill themselves, ooh, that's creepy. That's all you can tell them. There's nothing else to add to it. There's no hook. There's no layers to it. I can't find more that makes it more interesting. I can tell the story in a sentence. And because of that, it's not a good topic for an episode. It's still a really creepy story or idea. It's just not good for Lore. So I don't trust people to come up with those topics on their own. I have to do it myself. Now, Marcette will occasionally come to me and say, hey, in the process of doing this thing, I found this topic, and I think it would be great for what I call Lore Extras. I use Patreon like you. Mm-hmm. And because Lore comes out every other week, in the off Mondays, I give my Patreon backers a shorter episode. It's usually, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 minutes long. It's usually just one story, but it's all written the same way. It's all told the same way, has the same music. And they're good little stories. And I've trusted her to go find extra material before. And that's been really helpful.
That's a really great way to reward your patrons too. But
yeah, absolutely. No, I was just going to say, it's, you know, what I learned really early on was what people just wanted more of was the podcast. And I couldn't do weekly episodes.
You do that in October, right? And I that sort of spoiled people for Halloween.
It spoiled them last year. And it also taught me that was the stupidest thing I've ever done, because keeping up with writing. Yeah. What ended up happening was because of the every other week rhythm and filling in the in-betweens with other episodes, I had to put out 5 episodes in a row. Like every week of October last year, and then the first week of November were all release days before I got a break. And writing 5 episodes in a row that quickly like that just crushed me. I think I was sick for 2 weeks afterwards, because I also had 2 live shows. Maybe it was 3 live shows. I had the early phases of the TV stuff was taking place, so I was traveling for that. It was crushing me. And I couldn't do it. This year, what I did is in the off weeks, I took some of the Lore Extras from the Patreon stuff, and I packaged a couple of them up into little sets that I put out in the off weeks. And that worked really well. People enjoyed that.
I take back what I said about your gut leading you in the right direction, because that just sounds insane.
Yeah, I know.
How has the process changed in, how long has it been? 9 months? 10 months?
Oh, Lore? Yeah. Oh, it's about 20 months old now at this point. It's been flying by.
Wow. Okay. So yeah. How has the process changed in the last 20 months?
You know, not a lot. I figure it became popular because of what I was doing in the beginning. So I've tried to just honor that DNA and, you know, just keep repeating the thing that I'm doing. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's also a pretty pure storytelling format. There's not a lot that I can stray away from. You know, I don't do interviews. I don't do talking heads or sound clips. You know, I listen to an episode like, you know, podcast like 99% Invisible. You know, Roman's a friend of mine. He's amazing. His whole team is talented. I can't imagine building an episode like they build with all those moving pieces, where they interview people and record it, where they take sound clips from other people, where they move in music and sound effects, and it's mind-boggling. I don't have a big box, so I can stay right inside of it. It's pure storytelling, and I don't want to break that. So I try to just tell the story.
You quit your freelance job as a designer after Lore became self-sustaining.
Yeah.
But you've always worked for yourself. You've always been an at-home worker. You actually had a podcast about working from home.
Called Homework.
Yeah, exactly. So how do you make sure that you get your work done and you don't end up lost on Twitter or putzing around the internet?
Yeah, it's a battle, isn't it? I mean, even if you're just writing a book, that's a huge battle, because distraction is...
Even with the noblest of intentions, going in to research something, you end up in a Wikipedia rat hole.
Yeah. And then, let me read this. Mm-hmm. Oh, let me read this. I've lost hours to stuff like that. And you're a homeowner. You know how like water can just get anywhere, right? You just had to repair your bathroom.
Yes.
We did ours in January in the same fashion that you're doing it, like down to the studs and redo it, because water was coming from somewhere and going everywhere it wanted to go. You mm-hmm. know, and distraction is like water. It gets everywhere and it creeps in. And so it's taken me a long time to learn some of these skills, but I've literally, like, across all my devices, I've turned off Twitter notifications for replies, follows, favorites, all that stuff. The only thing I get notifications for now is direct messages. And my laptop, which I write on at the cafe every morning, is permanently set on do not disturb. Just nothing comes through. Nothing pops up on my screen to distract me, because I'm a 5-year-old boy. You know, just something pops up and I have to chase it. So, and I'm also addicted to email. If I see the red badge, I need to take care of it. So I hide my dock, right? So that I don't see the badge. And I just have to know every now and then to take a peek down there if I'm looking for an important email or I have a responsibility to somebody through email. So, I've had to fight it. And it's not something that you just master and then you say, oh, good, I fixed that. Now I can move on. Like, it's just a constant daily battle.
Yeah, it is. And I've got to try some of your techniques, because I'm absolutely horrible when it comes to... for me, it's having access to Netflix, HBO Go, Stars Play, and Showtime Anytime. Basically, if there's a movie I wanted to watch, I will end up doing that instead of writing or doing what I was supposed to do.
You know, one of the things that Dave and I... So Dave Kahlo, my friend Dave Kahlo and I were the co-hosts of that Homework podcast, and we explored a lot of, you know, interesting theories and techniques and stuff for how to work from home effectively. One thing was... if you can, to have an office space that's dedicated just for work. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do just a room that's dedicated to work, I've tried to apply it to things like devices, you know, where I don't watch movies or Netflix or things like that on my laptop, because that's where I write my content. If I have a John Oliver clip that I want to watch, I will email the link to myself and I'll watch it on my desktop in my office when I get back to the office. I just don't watch that stuff on my laptop. And it's created this... you know, like the electric dog collar, like there's this invisible barrier that I just subconsciously obey now, that I know I don't do play stuff on my work thing, right? I only work on the laptop. And that's been really helpful for me, just to set that boundary there and make it solid.
That's part of the reason I wrote my second book by hand, is because there's no distraction with a notebook.
Right.
That's it. And then I would do any research I had to do, if it was looking up a word or a synonym or even just quick browsing on the internet, I do it on my phone, because I don't like long browsing on my phone.
Right.
So I would get in, do what I need to do, and get out. And that actually worked out really well. I should have done it for this one, but
yeah.
I wanted it down as fast as possible.
Right. Now, and I've heard stories of, you know, folks like George R.R. Martin who writes on this archaic computer that has no
DOS.
Internet connection. Is it a DOS? Yeah, it's DOS.
It's some DOS program he uses, yeah.
Like black screen, green letters kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's...
it's not WordPerfect. It was like WordStar, I think. Is that what it's called? WordStar?
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah, I think it's WordStar. And, you know, there's no internet, there's no distraction. But I think what people have to remember is he's writing fantasy. So he doesn't have to look anything up, right? He may have a binder with notes from previous novels and however he manages his fantasy world, but he's writing stuff that doesn't exist in our world. Now, when I'm writing a novel, I've invented a city in the Boston area, like a town, you know, kind of like how Stephen King has created Derry, mm-hmm. Maine as this fictional place. It's not real. It's just this place he made up. I found a gap in a map and I stuck a town there. And, but you know, if I want to have my character drive through another place, I'll literally open up Google Street View and I'll put myself where I think the car needs to be. And I'll look around and I'll say, oh, there's a building there on the left that has a really funny, you know, portcullis, or check out the windows on that church right there. Right. And then describe those in the book. And if in that random chance that somebody has read the book and then they're on that street, they see it, there's that little moment of connection. And it just, I don't know, I feel like it helps make things more real in that sense. So I don't believe in getting rid of all internet when you're writing. Like, you have to research to some degree. You have to dig in and find the stuff that's online.
Yeah. I mean, the one I'm writing has been like a trek across the country. And so it's essentially a treasure hunt, and the clues are all based around different landmarks around the country, sort of like National Treasure, but not, okay.
With more hair.
Yeah, and unfortunately less Nicolas Cage, but one of the clues is centered around Mount Vernon, and I can't get to Mount Vernon right now. So
right.
Unbelievably, I didn't realize they had done this. The Mount Vernon organization, the government organization, actually built a virtual tour of the house, so I can walk through the house and right. look at the paint colors and the furniture layout and everything, and do everything I need to do yeah. from the comfort of my own chair. It's unbelievable.
Right. You don't have to be Dan Brown jumping on a plane and flying to the Sistine Chapel and literally taking notes inside the building. Like, right. you can do this from home. And I think that's one of the powers that we have as modern authors, is we can learn quicker, right? We can learn more efficiently. And I like that.
Yeah. What do you do your writing in? How do you compile your research and the final essay?
It's a little bit of a Frankenstein, if I can use a horror metaphor.
I think it's only right that you do.
It is, yeah, yeah. All my personal research notes, links, and things like that live in Evernote, so that it's there, it's sortable. I can search by tag, all that kind of stuff.
Well, you're still using Evernote.
I love it. I love it. They can triple or double or quadruple the cost per year, and I'll keep paying it because I love its features.
Okay.
And I have a pretty religious tagging system that I don't tell people about that helps me find stuff really quick and helps me make my episodes just have a little bit more flavor to them, you know? So it's, yeah, that I do things like that in Evernote. Now, Google Docs is where me and the research assistant spend a lot of our time. Her research outlines go up there. I put finished episodes in there so she can read them and make sure that I've hit everything right. And then when I write, like the physical act of writing an episode, I do that in Pages. I do that in the whatever the current version of Apple's Pages program is.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I've got a template file. You know, I copy a new folder every time I have a new episode. I open up the file, the Pages file that's inside it. So it's already got the font and everything. I don't have to putz around with font size, color, all that stuff. It's set.
Excellent. And so even though it is a lot of, like you said, a lot of Frankensteining pieces together, sync is a big part of what you do.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Because I, you know, if I bump into something on my phone, like somebody posts a link to, you know, creepy historical archaeological blunders, whatever, I might save that link from my phone into Evernote. So it's there waiting for me later.
Okay. There's an old platitude people like to throw around that goes something like, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. As lore grows, do you ever worry that it will become to you more like work than play and that you'll grow to resent it?
You know, lore is a metric crap ton of work each and every day. And I like that sentiment, you know, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. But I think it deceives people into thinking that they won't have to work hard if they find something that they love,
mm-hmm.
you know, or that the work might not tire them out or be stressful. Yeah, it's helpful to love what you do. And I certainly absolutely love what I do. But working hard is still working hard, right? It doesn't change. I'm exhausted at the end of each day. I sit on my butt and type half the day, and then the other half of the day I read or I take meetings, and I'm physically exhausted, and I'm either a tremendous wuss, or which is, there's a lot of odds that that's true, or I'm actually working really hard. You know, I enjoy my weekends out of the office. I look forward to small breaks. My wife and I are going to take Thursday and Friday at the end of this week and just go away for a couple of nights and leave the kids with the grandparents because they're in town. And you know, sometimes I wish I could take a full blown 2 week vacation. But I think the core of this hard work thing is that there's no bitterness, right? There's no hopelessness,
right?
Because I'm working a lot, like everybody else is working hard. Hopefully, I'm working really hard each day, but I'm doing it for myself. It's my creation. It's my business. And I think if I was working for someone else, you know, working for the man, as people say, that would make it a lot harder to stay motivated and more hopeful for my own goals in my future. So I think that's where the aspect of, you know, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life come in. Because built into that is this assumption that if you're doing what you love, you're doing it for yourself, right? And unless you just really, really love accounting and you want to go work at, you know, IBM in their accounting department, and that's cool. You know, you can do that and you'll probably enjoy the hell out of your job. But, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to resent lore. I think I work really hard and I walk away from it with no bitterness. You know, it's very hopeful.
Right. Right. As hard as it is for you to put everything together, to manage everything, it's more fulfilling than anything else you would do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And because if we go back to that evergreen, timeless idea, I do feel like I'm creating content that doesn't lose its value as time goes on. You know, I'm putting things on paper, digital or physical, that I'm building assets, right? You know, it's not something that I talk about a lot, but my literary agent is working with me on kind of restricting access to my transcripts, because down the road, those transcripts are things that could be published. And the more I have disseminated them out into the world, the less valuable they are to be published down the road, you know? So,
right.
So I look at every single episode that I write as this new, I've crafted a new brick of gold and I can put that in a chest somewhere in the basement. You know, it's like I'm stacking up, resources by creating this stuff.
Is there ever a worry that what you have created might come crashing down at any point?
In the last hour or so? No. But on a daily basis, yeah, I always worry that what if the story that I'm producing right now is just the last good one I can find? You know, what if I can't find anything else to tell people, or my show is so basic and simple that, you know, what if something better comes along? Right. And I don't know. I have to trust the fact that it's pretty darn popular for a pretty simple show.
Well, we've seen clones come and go and nothing's really amounted there.
Yeah. I know they say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, but imitation is just irritating. And you know, Samsung is proof of this. You can copy all you want, but you have to capture the core as well.
Well, I don't expect any of the lore clones to blow up my phone. So there is that.
There is that. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's good to worry. I think it's good to, I think that's that hunger, right? You don't want the lizard brain to take over and make you complacent and lazy. You want to constantly look at things and say, is this the best I can do? You know, can I do better? And that's what I really aim for every day. And for as long as this roller coaster goes, I'm gonna ride it with my arms in the air screaming, you know?
Yeah, I'd like to go back a little bit to the little aside on the clones and the other shows, because yeah. I'm gonna put you on the spot here. You're an opinionated person on Twitter, and you specifically around writing and podcasting, and I've called you out on stuff before when I thought you've been unfair. I sometimes think of myself as your Jiminy Cricket. So I'm curious, what is it that makes you comment on these topics? What is it that irks you and makes you feel like you have to get your opinion out there?
Just on like podcasting in general?
Podcasting and occasionally I've seen you comment on the writing aspect of it as well. But yeah, mainly the podcasting.
Well, and admittedly, I think I'm viewing the world from under my own porch, you know, and my view is limited, but I did something that works. I mean, that's an undeniable truth here. I don't know what it is, but I did something that works, right? And I've managed to build my show into something bigger than what a lot of people hope for. And I guess I'm very heavy-handedly trying to offer advice for people who want to do the same thing. I don't do it very well. And I certainly have a problem with understanding that there might be five paths to the same goal instead of one, just because there was one path that I followed and it worked. So, I can be a little opinionated. I try to shut up more often these days than anything.
I think there's a worry there about, for lack of a better word, privilege. I mean, I've had this conversation with Lawrence Block too, where he went into self-publishing and he does very well for himself, but he also had decades of building an audience and a backlist and just a huge following. And so when he went out on his own, he had an audience built in already to follow him there. And I mm-hmm. feel sometimes when you comment on podcasting that way, when you say, well, it's just a matter of working hard and putting good content out. Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. And it's something I struggle to do every 2 weeks. But it's also, you know, you did have the homework audience that followed you. You also had a lot of followers on Twitter, and you had a successful blog at one point, I believe. And so you had these avenues to, and I think you had a mailing list as well, which is how this whole thing started, right? So you had these avenues to get lore out there. And from the, you know, you tell 50 people and they tell another 50 people themselves, and it just spirals that way. And so I think part of that is also not everybody starts at the same level when they're creating something.
Yeah. I mean, there's some truth there. I mean, there are some shadows of truth there. I mean, I had the Read and Trust Network for a while.
Those fighting words, Aaron.
I know. You remember Read and Trust, right? You know,
yes,
I was gathering a number of bloggers
in the
same space. Yeah, Sean Blanc and Brett Kelly and Brett Terpstra. Anybody named Brett, pretty much.
Yeah.
Dave Kalo, Dave Chartier. You know, the idea was, it was kind of like the old school early 90s link list or mid 90s link list, where at the bottom of a web page, like an X-Files fan page, you'd see, you know, click the next link in the ring, and then it would take you to somebody else's fan page. And it was a way of sharing fans, sharing followers. But you know what? At its height, the Read and Trust Network, I had about 150 paying subscribers to the little magazine I was putting out once a month. And that was about as big as it ever got. My mailing list, that lore actually started out as a tool to grow my mailing list. I had 66 people on it. And I thought, well, if I give people an incentive, like some document I've written up about creepy stories from history, maybe more people will sign up. And so when I put out a new book, they'll go buy it. And I think that list now has a few hundred on it, but people just, I don't know. They're more interested in the podcast now than they are in the fiction, which is, you know, what happens.
I was going to talk about this a little later on, but you've written several horror novels. Are there plans to go back and to write more of them, or is lore your primary focus right now?
Yeah, it's super ironic, isn't it? I mean, like I said, lore was supposed to drive fiction book sales, because I was looking for a reason. I was looking to justify my writing in my spare time. You know, I was making about $5 a month self-publishing my novels. Mm-hmm. And every time I sat down at Starbucks, which is where I used to write my stuff, it cost me $5 to sit down with a drink. And so I was already in the hole every month. And, you know, I had a design business going, and I had to justify that I was spending time on writing and not on something else that could actually support my family.
Right.
So that's what lore began as. And it didn't even start out as audio. It was going to be a PDF that people downloaded. But yeah, at some point lore exploded. It became my sole source of income within about 5 months. And then with everything that's happened, it's kind of consuming all of my time. I think I would love to write more novels. You know, the last book I put out, Grave Suspicion, there's the intent that there is at least one more book, with the same characters. And I'll eventually get there. You know, I like writing fiction, but I'd probably be writing fiction right now in my spare time if the TV show hadn't come along. But that's kind of the, you know, it walks into the room and it takes the biggest seat on the couch, right?
Right.
Right now, fiction just has to wait a while. And I've had conversations with my agent about, you know, this thing called collaborative writing, you know, where I would outline the plot and the flow and the beats of a series of novels, and then a hired writer would write the novel, and then I would read it and edit it. And part of the process.
Like when
James Patterson
exactly.
Does, yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Or Tom Clancy when he was still alive. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a ton of authors that do it. It's not perfect. There's, you know, strong opinions on either side. It's certainly not my words on the page, but it would be my DNA, you know, my story DNA in there and my point of view, my ideas and perspectives and whatnot. It's just an interesting idea that might allow me to get fiction out. There's a lot of stories I want to tell. There's a lot of neat ideas I've been tucking away. But at this point, time will tell. You know, just I got to get through the first season of the TV show first, see what happens, see if there's a second season, see where lore goes. Yeah, we'll figure it out.
You're a podcaster and blogger. You need an analytics and hosting platform that provides you with the right tools to make your job easier, so you can get back to doing what you do best, creating stuff. FeedPress is a delightfully intuitive RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform with accurate analytics for RSS feeds and email newsletters. Bloggers and podcasters tap into RSS subscriber, geolocation, podcast download, and link tracking metrics, which come standard on all plans. In a matter of minutes, podcasters can create a feed and publish to iTunes, add your show notes, artwork, and drag and drop an MP3 into the editor to go live. Every podcast plan comes with 400 megabytes of file storage that's unmetered. This means you won't have to worry about running out of storage for long episodes or getting dinged for a sudden spike in download traffic when your podcast becomes an overnight success. FeedPress offers an automatic feed burner migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Your feeds and subscriber data will be moved into your FeedPress account. And if you're currently hosting a podcast elsewhere, they can help you migrate your feeds and media files over so that your listeners don't notice you've changed anything. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via feed.press/contact. Sign up today and try FeedPress on a 14-day commitment-free trial at feed.press/covered. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year. Do you ever worry about being pigeonholed as, quote, the horror guy? You know, Stephen King does numerous, he writes in numerous genres, but he's always remembered as the horror guy.
Yeah. And that's there's so many good Stephen King books. And I, you know, 112263 is one of my favorite novels ever. It's just such a beautiful book. It's a monster of a book. It's huge. It's like over 1,000 pages, I think, but it's one of the best
books I've
ever read.
Yeah, that and Under the Dome are ginormous.
Oh, Under the Dome is great too. But you know, if I bring up to somebody who is clearly not a horror fan that I love Stephen King, they tend to shy away from any book recommendations. And I always tell them, oh, you've got to read 112263. Just set aside your expectations for what Stephen King is and go read that book. And it shows off that while he might write stories that have scary elements, this guy can just write, you know? I think it's sort of happened for me already. I didn't set out for Lore to be a horror podcast. It was never meant to be scary. It was, it's about interesting, fascinating historical events and stories, but they do have a supernatural or a mysterious flavor. And maybe the music adds to that too. But it's dark history for sure. I don't know. I horror might push it a little bit too far. There's a lot of scary stuff out there. I will say this. I think a career without focus is a career that's destined to fail. You know, if you dabble in everything, you master in nothing. So if I have to accept the mantle of horror podcaster, I'll take it. Cause I'm building a writing career around telling suspenseful stories and, you know, stories that have roots in historical fact. So if focusing on that one thing earns me a positive reputation that I can build my working life on, then I think I've paved a pretty nice road for a career. But if you dabble, you know, if you do a little here, a little there, I'll do a romance comedy and then I'll do an action thriller. Like, I don't know. I just feel like that might spread you too thin, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Is there anything about the TV show you can talk about?
Well, there's not a lot, mostly because of where we're at in the process. But one of the things I do like to talk about is just how frustratingly slow, but also amazingly encouraging the whole process is. I mean, I was on a Skype call 45 minutes ago with people who have won, you know, major awards and have Wikipedia pages longer than, you know, most whatever, long pages. I write for a living. It's great.
You're batting 1,000, Aaron.
I know. That's so bad. I'll let you edit that stuff out. Make that's me sound fine. Smart. Yeah. To see all of the talent, all of the money, all of the time being spent on something that I created is just really, really cool. It's so, I know humbling isn't the right word because it's not using the word correctly, but it gets the point across. Like it makes me feel very, very grateful and blessed, if you want to use that word. Like I'm like, wow, this is actually happening. It's actually really cool too, to watch the process, you know, how you pitch a show to a network and then how networks make the deal and then how you start the process of building the show. And, you know, you have to hire a showrunner who's like the CEO of the show and they're going to run the show. And, you know, we hired Glenn Morgan, you know, storied X-Files writer and producer. He wrote my favorite episode, the one called Home with the inbred brothers and the mother under the bed on the roll cart, that basically set TV ratings, as we know them today. Rated R, violence, that kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they had to go back after that episode and refigure the how do we tell parents if this is okay for kids to watch?
Oh, like TVMA, TV-14, that whole thing.
That stuff. Yeah, that's all a product of Home from Glenn Morgan. And for like a decade or more, they didn't air that episode ever again. It aired once and then never again because they just didn't want to mess with it. Anyway, yeah, and so right now we've gone through the process of, you know, hiring the showrunner, and then you have to hire directors and hire writers, and now we're finalizing scripts and, you know, tossing around story ideas for later episodes in the season. And it's a pretty interesting process. That's the stuff that I get excited about right now, which is just, this is so cool and different than what I normally do. And it's fun. You know, I'm learning as I go. I had to buy Final Draft, which is like the
industry. I used to have Final Draft.
Oh, yeah?
I wrote a screenplay after high school for a contest. Actually, my senior project was an adaptation of a Lawrence Block short story into a screenplay, and I ended up buying Final Draft for that. I hated that software. God, that was awful.
Yeah, I don't know that it's gotten better. I've never used the old stuff, but they're on version 10 right now, and all I know is that I just need to open up a script and go through and edit my dialogue right now, just to make sure it fits my mouth. And that little experience has been okay. But, you know, it's just, I'm learning all these new things and learning industry terms and, you know, how they, like the cool stuff they do with the physical scripts. You know, the first official copy handed out is called the white copy because it's all on white paper with a white cover. And then if they change page 5, it'll go to a new color, but everything else stays white. Page 5 just changes color.
Oh, cool. So that's how they track changes. Neat.
And so, yeah, if you're sitting around the table and everybody's doing a line read and somebody's confused, they'll all look at the person's script and say, oh, yeah, you're working on yesterday's script. And they'll say, oh, blankety blank, and they'll get the new script out. So it's this really cool physical way to organize the data and the editing process, which I find, just from a writer's standpoint, very fascinating.
That's very cool. So how does or does the TV show affect the podcast?
Hopefully really, really positively.
Well, I'm also talking like, you know, if you come up with a show idea for the podcast and do the TV people turn around and say, you can't do that one, we're going to do that one or that kind of thing.
No. There, you know, the TV show is its own thing. It's inspired by the podcast. I own the podcast. I haven't sold it to anybody. The first season of the TV show will be 10 episodes, which is pretty standard for Amazon. 7 will be topics we've covered on the podcast and 3 will be stories we haven't covered on the podcast. So it's kind of a little bit of a split there.
Very cool.
You know, I think that they're really open to, hey, if you want to write a podcast about this new topic and release it coinciding with the TV episode, that'd be cool. But there's no pressure to, it's very much, you know, flexible and positive between the two of them. But, you know, who knows? Maybe this thing will do a season and then that's it. But that's one season where millions of people on Amazon are going to learn about this thing called lore. They'll even learn about podcasts, you know, because I don't think everybody's heard about a podcast yet. So The theory is.
Yeah, it's a surprising thing to. I'm actually doing a presentation tonight on how to start a podcast at my local library because it's something that, you know, for us it's an everyday thing, but for a lot of people it is still discoverability is not easy.
It's not easy. And explaining things like RSS feeds and subscribing and, you know, I think I've had conversations with other people in the industry where we're pretty much in agreement. Subscribe should be replaced with follow. You know, the button should say follow because that's what people understand. They, you know, they click follow on Twitter. They should click follow on a podcast. I don't know. It also encourages the thought that it's free, that you're just going to follow it. There's no pressure. You're not
true,
subscribing
actually.
Like a magazine.
I was against the terminology change because to me, subscribe says, you know, click this and every new episode will be delivered to you automatically. But
now that
you mentioned that with follow, that the implication is the same thing. You'll get all the updates and also it's free.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah,
okay. You've absolutely. Changed my mind, Aaron Mankey.
No, nice, nice. I know it can be done now. I'll file that away.
Good.
But it's all good. I think that, you know, even if the TV show bombs after one season, I'm going to pick up a lot more listeners of the podcast because they'll discover what it is. And hopefully more podcasts will pick up listeners just in general because people, they realize, oh, there's this whole world of free, amazing content out there that I can just go and download all the time. Right? I mean, that's why I always tell people I'm excited for the Lore TV show because I made a TV show, but I'm also excited because it's so, so good for podcasting, right? It's just, it's going to be good. Rising tides lift all ships. And I think this is going to be really helpful for a lot of people.
Excellent. Well, I don't want to keep you too long because I know you're a very busy man, but I do have one final question for you.
Yeah.
The catalog of scripted research podcasts is growing. We've got Myths and Legends. We've got your show. We've got Serial. I mean, it's getting out of hand. So to someone looking to start his or her own show in that vein, what advice would you give them?
Well, you know, you have your own story to tell and you might, you know, go back to my friend Roman. He says copy, you know, like look at the way 99% Invisible handles their transitions between narration and interview, like just as a technical thing. Like you can look at that and go try it on your own, but you have to be willing to say that particular method doesn't work as it is in my show. I have to tweak it somewhat. So like make it your own, tell your own story, right? But I always tell people, don't go in with a competitive attitude because people will listen to your show and a bunch of other shows, right? So don't think that you have to be the serial killer. That was a really bad example. Actually, I did not think that through.
Well done.
You don't have to be the Lore, you know, killer or the Myths and Legends killer. You just need to create a really good show and they'll listen to both. And I think that's really powerful and it's really encouraging for new people because it means that they can get up to speed and so much quicker. I think podcasts that are launching nowadays are launching with so many more subscribers than the ones that launched 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, because there's just so many more possible listeners out there. So just go in and tell your own story, make it your own, put your own fingerprint on it, do it your own way and do your best work ever. And people will follow.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Aaron, so much for coming on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
This has been Covered with special guest Aaron Mankey. Thank you for listening. If you like today's show, I would love it if you would take a few minutes to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes so other book lovers can better find us. And if your podcast listening app gives you the ability to recommend us, please do. You can find links to Aaron's show, his Twitter, everything in our show notes. In fact, Aaron, where can people find you?
Easiest way would be to go to lorepodcast.com and it's got the social links in the footer. But it's Lore Podcast everywhere. Lore Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I may have opened a Tumblr a couple of years ago, but I have no idea where it's at. But yeah, there you go.
Very cool. Thank you so much to our Patreon patrons, Kyle Wallace, Alex Knight, my guest, Aaron Mankey. If you're able to give a dollar or two an episode, it would help fund more wonderful interviews like this. And any support would be super appreciated. And the higher up we go in our support, the more rewards like t-shirts and stuff I can give out. So let's do that. And if you fancy other Hologram Radio shows and would like to drop a few bucks their way, you can support the network as a whole at patreon.com/hologramradio. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth, hosting costs, and equipment upgrades. You can follow me on Twitter at HCMarks, and you can follow the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for our wonderful logo, and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to Feed Press and Nox Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.